Thank you for taking the ride on the Freedom Train Podcast Series. I'm your host, Joseph Ward, and as always, ride with me is my homie, Mr. Patrick Irvin. And remember, the Freedom Train is brought to you by PAX, Inc. That's P-A-C-T-S-I-N-C. And PAX, Inc. is a black development organization aimed at developing the black community to its maximum potential through a focus on education and economics with the traits of hard work, honesty, and integrity. For more information, make sure you visit the website at www.pactsinc.org. That way you can learn more about the organization, their codes of conduct, how to become a member, how to donate, how to get involved in community activities, and hover your mouse over the More tab so you can go to the Learning Center and the store to be able to learn more as well as support. You know how we do it. And while you're online, make sure you visit our Freedom Train website at www.freedomtrainradio.com. Learn more about myself, Patrick, all of the hosts of our numerous podcasts, and also to tune in on the podcast and get down on this great information that we'll be sliding, y'all, because we'll be putting it down on the network. We'll be putting all the way down. And remember, we got a couple shows that are on Patreon that you should go and support to help be able to deliver more content and improve the platform. So there's Lessons from the Screen. So patreon.com, LFTS, Lessons from the Screen, as well as patreon.com/fix. That way you can support the Fix Sports Podcast, you can support Lessons from the Screen, and overall that's going to help support the network and grow and just become more powerful, be able to deliver more information to the community. Because remember, this podcast platform is FUBU, for us, by us. Pat,
what up?
What it look like?
What the hook going to be?
Y'all still got all that snow up there in North Carolina?
Nah, it's dried up. I mean, it's still spotty, but it's gone. It's melted.
Man, where was the first place you saw snow? Because coming from Tallahassee, you ain't seen no real snow.
You mean like snow, like real snow? Because we had a couple winters in Tallahassee where it didn't make it to the ground, but you could see it in the air.
Well, yeah, you know, we did have a couple of these. I don't know what this article want to play this stuff, but Tallahassee has had like those snows to where by the time you get up in the morning, it's gone. So I remember the snow of 89 when it snowed on the it was enough snow to go collect it off the car, but it wasn't a real snow.
Yeah, no, the first time I saw snow was probably when I was driving from Texas to Delaware when I was in the military, driving from the training base down there. I forget what it's called now because I like purged so much of that from my memory to Dover Air Force Base. And I remember when I got to Dover, it was in the middle of a snowstorm. It was like negative 20 degrees, wind chill factor, something like that. It was like 2 or 3 feet of snow on the ground. It was crazy. So that was like the first time I saw snow. That was like the first time I saw any kind of major snow. And it just happened to be in the middle of what I thought was a blizzard. Man, I thought I was going to die.
Hey, I bet. Shoot. Like that scene from Cool Runnings when they first hit the snow.
Yeah, it was people driving around in it, and I was just like, yo, these people is crazy. Yo, like, I pulled over to the side of the road for a little bit, for like an hour, and just sat there, like, you know, I'm waiting for it to stop. I ain't fixing to kill myself trying to drive in this. And, you know, when I realized I was the only person pulled over, and everybody else seemed to be getting where they had to go just fine, I was like, well, maybe it's okay. But I was a wreck, man.
I bet. I've never driven in snow, so I'd be nervous in the mud, but.
Yeah, the car hydroplaned a couple times. It slid and skidded, but that's because underneath the snow, the roads was icy. Yeah. So I didn't know that at the time. I just, you know, I don't know. It was a weird situation because I didn't know nothing about snow outside of what I saw in the movies. And so I knew, like, you was supposed to have, like, chains on your tires, but I ain't had no chains. But as I looked around, I ain't see other people with chains either. So I was just all around confused.
Man, look here. Y'all trying to kill all of us. Hey, man, it's all good, man. Man, so today on the Freedom Train podcast series, we got a couple topics that we want to get into. First topic is we want to talk about the Santoya Brown case, kind of give our thoughts on it, and just try to bring in other lines of thinking with the Santoya Brown case. And also look at it in the grand scheme of things when we talk about justice in America, because, you know, a lot of times it ain't just us. It's just us. You know what I'm saying? And then also we're going to talk about the controversy surrounding the taking down of the Gandhi statue at the University of Ghana, because a lot of information has resurfaced about Gandhi and his thoughts and ideas and actions towards African people. So we're going to dig into that. But we want to start with the Santoya Brown case. This is going to be the bulk of our discussion today, the Santoya Brown case, because it needs to be talked about. Black outlets, black news outlets need to be talking about this, need to be giving different viewpoints and different information so we can kind of put the pieces of the puzzle together to be able to really see what's going on, because Santoya Brown is a victim of sex trafficking and abuse, but she's in prison right now serving a 51-year sentence because she killed somebody. So you want to get a rundown real quick, since I've been talking a lot?
Well, for those that haven't watched the documentary, and I haven't, but I might go and check it out.
I haven't watched the documentary either. I just read a lot of the documents. So
apparently, the rundown, you want to start all the way. So going back, you're talking about this young lady basically right now is in prison for killing somebody. She shot a John, and she
claims his name was Johnny too.
She claims it was self defense when she was 16, and they said that it wasn't self defense because of what happened. So that's essentially why she's in prison. But a little bit of the backstory to that is, you know, when she was 16 years old, she comes from, you know, a broken home of a mother that was addicted to substance abuse and a father who was addicted to substances and an alcoholic. And even to that, there's some discrepancy even in what they're reporting about that, because some people say that her father was never there. She never knew her father because he left. And other articles and people and narratives are that her father was there and he was abusive. And then there are other articles that say that it wasn't her mother or her father, her biological parents. She was put up for adoption, and the people she was adopted by were abusive. I've literally read articles and heard people make all three of those arguments.
But so, either way, it was some adults fucking up.
Right. No matter how you slice it, she had a childhood that was less than preferable. We'll say that. So when she's 16 years old, she began partying and drinking and basically following the pattern that was set out before her, like most people do. They follow the patterns of the adults in their lives. At a party, when she was 16, she snuck out, went to a party where she met this man.
Cutthroat. Nicknamed Cutthroat.
Garyon McLaughlin.
Bitch boy. He a bitch. Let's put that on the paper too.
And she met him actually at a house party where she met this dude. You know what? And this is another thing, right? They're not even clear on where she met this dude. Because I've heard a bunch of stories about where she met the dude as well. So in any case, she ended up selling crack for this dude. So she was, you know, she was selling crack for the man. Some stories have said he was already in prison when she started selling crack for him. Some stories say that he went to prison and then she just... So, you know, even to that, it's kind of like... And that's why I say I got to watch the documentary. Maybe she spells it out in her own words in the documentary. Because I read, like I told you, I read numerous articles and I just kept getting different narratives and different information. So anyways, she sold crack for him. And when he got out of prison, he invited her to join him on a trip to Florida where they would buy and sell cocaine. And I presume use it as well. So from Florida, they went to a hotel room in Nashville. And even to that, there are some stories that say she never even went to Florida. There are other stories that say that she went to Florida and came back. So in either case, at some point in time, after they had made the arrangement to go to Florida, he took her to a motel room in Nashville. He laced her with something, gave her a drink. She believes that it was laced with a drug. And while she was drugged up, he raped her numerous times. So from that point on, this dude basically became her pimp. She would charge $250 or more. That would fund the motel rooms that they were living in because they were homeless, as well as the, you know, their drug habits. And so on August 5th, 2004, she was solicited by John Allen, in the parking lot of a Sonic Drive-In fast food restaurant in Nashville, Tennessee. Now, they say at around 11 p.m. that night, he drove her back to his home, where she feared, I don't know if it was before they had sex or after they had sex, but there are reports to say that her paranoia was fueled by a two-week cocaine bender. So she was all coked up on Mountain Dew. The dude, she felt like she was worried that the dude was reaching for a gun because apparently he kept, from her perspective, reaching under his bed. So she shot him with her loaded gun. She took two rifles from his house. She took $172 in cash, and she took his car, his Ford F-150, and she fled the scene. Now, the cops came in, and this is essentially why she's in prison. The cops said the residue showed that he was shot in the back of the head at close range, and that they found his hands clasped under him on the bed. So they said that he was sleeping. Now, if she's all coked up on drugs and she's paranoid, then that would make sense, especially if his back is to her, that she would think that he's reaching for something. I could see that. But she shot him in the back of the head when she was 16. And there are reports that the police said he was sleeping. The police also said that there's no proof that she had been trafficked since she was 12 years old. They also said that...
hell proof you gonna have?
Well, they also denied that she was a prostitute, and they said that she had only known the man Cutthroat for about a month. So that's what the police are saying.
Well, see, there's, like you said, there's a lot of conflicting information because, like, I'm reading court documents here. Let me read this. It says, the petitioner waived her Miranda rights and gave a statement to the police in which she said that the night of August 6, 2004, she was walking near a Sonic Drive-In when the victim, whom she did not know, picked her up in his truck. He drove her to the Sonic, they ordered food, and the victim offered to let her spend the night at his home. The petitioner, who was Centoria, accepted the victim's offer, and they went to his house. There, the victim showed the petitioner some guns, and they got in the bed together. The victim whispered to and touched the petitioner and reached under the bed. The petitioner thought the victim was reaching for a gun. She pulled a .40 caliber handgun out of a purse and shot him. She took the money out of the victim's wallet, tore off his guns, drove the truck to the Walmart parking lot, and had someone drive her to the hotel where she was arrested later. The petitioner denied that she was a prostitute, that she had sex with the victim. Now, there are a lot of conflicting stories, but look, that's just that part of them saying that whether he was asleep or not, because these are court documents that are saying that, according to everything that's on record, he wasn't asleep. He was touching her. He was aware, alert, but he reached under the bed. When he reached under the bed, she took that as him going for a gun.
Well, that's her statement to the court.
Right. Now, but for right now, that's all they got. you know.
Yeah, they got her statement, and then they got the police statement, which essentially said he was asleep, and her statement, which said basically he wasn't. But they do have, you know, she did deny being a prostitute.
Right. She didn't deny killing him, but she did deny being a prostitute initially, and then came back and told the truth.
Right. And she also, she is also the person that said that she had only known the man that later, that she later called her pimp for about a month. Now, I don't know if she came back around to that as well, but I do know that they took statements from the friend of the guy, and the friend of the guy that she killed said that there was no proof that he paid for sexual services from the girl, which kind of confirms her story that it wasn't, you know, a prostitution thing where he paid for sex.
Well, because how do you confirm that somebody paid for sex?
That's true, but
her story and Whitney Houston's story agree. Right. I mean, now I get that, but he sounded like Whitney Houston talking about receipts for crack. Like, who has prostitution receipts? Like, come on, man. Like, stop being stupid, man.
And no, nobody, I agree.
And I get where they're going with that. It's like, well, there's no proof that he paid for sex. Bitch, it ain't supposed to be no proof he paid for sex.
Right. That's kind of the whole point of the thing.
But you still, as a friend, my first question would be, hold up, my homeboy 43,
right,
what you doing picking up 16-year-olds?
Right.
You can buy sex all you want, but why are you picking up 16-year-olds?
Right.
But I'm still gonna side eye you for buying sex, too, though.
As if any of my friends are purchasing sex, I got two requirements. One, that they be of age, and two, that they be pimp free.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still talking about your ass, but still, that's your business. You're grown.
Homie, knowing that you buying sex from a woman who's not being forced
right.
into it.
Because there are women who are not forced into prostitution who do that. I do believe that there are more who are forced in it, but there are.
Right. Of course. I'm not going to defend the profession and the brutality.
Just being real with the breakdown of it, though. Just being real.
But that's something I said in my show on Lessons from the Screen when I covered the documentary Trick. There are, like you just said, there are women out there. I've met one, so I know there's at least one they don't have a pimp. And they know they can do other things, but this is just what they do.
I've talked to several on my end, and it's one who I give condoms to on a regular basis. Who, she has no pimp. She's out there doing it because she's in the lifestyle now. So now, did she start off with a pimp? I don't know, but she doesn't have one now.
So, and that's not to, and you know, we got to keep saying, it's not saying that all of the girls you see are pimp free and they've made a decision. And it's not even to say that the lifestyle and the decision itself isn't destructive by itself. But it is to say that if you're a grown adult and that's the life you choose to live, right, that's your business. That's not my place to question that. But in this case, why, like you just said, why are you, as a 40-year-old man, 40-plus-year-old man, picking up a 16-year-old girl? Now, some people would be like, yo, well, these 16-year-olds don't look... Look, bro, I'm not saying I ain't been fooled, but I am saying that I will card you if you don't look like you clearly over 30.
You got to ask certain questions. I don't care how long a 16-year-old been out in the streets. She still got the mind of a 16-year-old.
Right. I've never been fooled in a conversation by a JIT.
Right. Not in a conversation. You might have fooled me as far as your look, because you don't look like you're 16. But once we start talking, oh yeah, how you say you was again?
Right. And if you got her in your house showing her your guns and shit, y'all are conversing.
Right. And then, like, I've been in conversations with 21-year-olds. I'm like, damn. You 21 like a mug, ain't you? So, 16-year-old, come on, man. But it's like, you know, for me, it's looking at Johnny and then looking at Cutthroat. Like, nobody's looking to go arrest Cutthroat.
Well, that's the thing. Like, is he back in jail or not? Because there are so many loose ends, not just around what happened with this story, but around all of the people involved. Like, how can you still claim to be a friend of Allen's, knowing that he's picking up random 16-year-old girls and inviting them to his house to sleep in the bed with him,
right.
Even if sex
right.
ain't on the menu?
So now they're at a point to where they're petitioning the governor to grant clemency before he leaves in January, and I think it's like a 50-50 thing where it's just up to his. Well, he could do what he wanted to do. Yeah, it's up to him. He could do what he wanted to do. But something I was reading where they said they had four people and two people were for the clemency, two people were against the clemency. But
yeah, her that was a clemency board or her parole, or I'm not sure if it was a parole hearing or a clemency hearing. But two of the people were for clemency. And two other people were for her serving at least 25 years.
But it's because it's like it's saying that the petitioner was tried as an adult and the jury rejected her claim of self-defense, finding her guilty of first-degree premeditated murder, initially first-degree felony murder, and especially aggravated robbery as a Class A felony. And so it's like, obviously, all of the information, either all of the information isn't brought to this case, or when the information is brought to this case, people just don't give a fuck. And they don't have no faith. I don't know, because how can you give me information in this case and I not be like, damn, well, she was a victim?
Yeah, see, that's where it gets dicey when you begin talking about what happened. Because even though she was a, well, and that's the thing, right? The two primary narratives are running completely in conflict with each other. One narrative is that she was a victim of sex trafficking and she was traumatized, and that, you know, she basically acted out as a traumatized person, a young person, and a sex trafficked person. And they also talk about how she had impulse control issues because her mother did drugs and she had fetal infant syndrome and alcoholism.
Right.
You know, so they list all of these things out to talk about where she was mentally, psychologically, that would cause her to do that. But then the competing narrative is that she wasn't a prostitute. She wasn't being pimped. She didn't have that sort of trauma. Now, maybe she did have all of the other trauma from the parenting and the bringing up, but this was a young girl who was a drug dealer and a drug user who went into this man's house with the sole purpose of murdering him and robbing him. Now, so those are the two narratives.
So where did they get that information from? And how do you, somebody who is on the outside looking in, say that, well, she wasn't a prostitute, she was this, she was that? Like, what evidence do they have to prove that?
Well, that's
what I want.
That's where you run into something that, you know, is always a problem when you're dealing with situations where people feel ashamed or they feel scared or all of these other things. Her very first statement to the court, you just read it earlier.
Yeah, she said she didn't prostitute.
She said she wasn't a prostitute, and she said that she had only known the man for about a month. Now, she later went on, came back, and changed it. But if you're going, but even to that, so which statement do you believe? Her initial statement or the statement she made later?
Now, I get that. And I get that. And for those who are listening, me and him not back and forth, we just putting ideas on the table.
Yeah, we just throwing it all out there.
So because as a traumatized victim, when you are encountering these things, because let's just be real, right? Her first inclination was to protect herself and cutthroat.
Right.
Let's just be real. That's the first. Why? Because she's been, if you in a traumatic situation, let's talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. Let's talk about it, because people get labeled with post-traumatic stress disorder from dealing with things far less than what she's dealt with. But we we understand the effects of PTSD when we want to. And that's one of my issues with this whole case is we are human beings when we want to, but when we don't want to be human beings, we just turn up to be some bullshit. So she may have lied in the beginning. They say she lied about things she done, but in a traumatic situation, I mean, think about it. You get teens who have less going on who lie about stuff to try to protect people. Like people in abusive relationships, they try to protect the abuser. That's normal behavior in abusive relationships. So I'm not understanding where's the Me Too movement? Where are they?
Well, here's the outline for me. One, you got to consider if she was a prostitute. A lot of the dynamics for how pimps control their prostitute is one, they develop an atmosphere where you can't trust anybody but me and nobody
right.
is going to protect you but me.
Right.
And so that atmosphere is reinforced by the fact that look at how we look at prostitutes. We look down on them. We think that they're lying. Mm-hmm. Prostitutes get arrested for prostitution, whether they're forced to do it or not. Which lends credibility to any pimp that wants to say, nobody's going to believe you anyway. I'm the only person that got your back because the cops
right.
will arrest you.
Right.
So all of that. So you got to think about socially how prostitutes are viewed by the outside world and how that works in conjunction with the way a lot of these pimps are grooming
right. Right, and like you say, that's why the pimps tell them that, because the pimps are master manipulators. They know these things.
Right.
And so it's I'm going to break you, it's about fear and dependency.
Right, and so when she gets locked up, for those of you who are, like Joe said, are like, yeah, well, she shouldn't have lied, or if I had that opportunity. Well, you're thinking that way as somebody that hasn't been through those things. If you've been through those things, and you don't know, we don't know how many times she may have been arrested for prostitution. So
we don't know how many times she got her ass whooped by cutthroat or a bitch.
Right,
we don't call her bitch boy.
There's a lot we don't know, but assuming she had either been arrested or seen other girls get arrested, they eventually get out and they have to deal with their pimp. Now, so she might have been thinking, well, I'm going to give this statement. But if I don't give a preferable statement for cutthroat, then when they let me out, cutthroat is going to fuck me up. So
right.
I'm going to do what I can. And we see this with other cases as well. If you look at prostitution cases, you will see cases where women will lie at first and be like, yo, that's just my friend, or we just met, or that's my family.
Right. They want to protect them people. I mean,
right.
People got to think about it, though. Like, I just use myself as an example. Let me be whooping on some girl's ass on a regular basis. Whether it's a month is enough time to beat fear into somebody. Hell, a week is enough time to beat fear into somebody. So don't sit there and try to minimize, oh, well, he only know her for a month. How many times did he whoop her ass, drug her, and rape her in a month?
Yeah, because it's people out there, and I know people don't want to be real about it. But it's people out there right now that have scared some of you off one encounter.
Right. Right. I mean, a lot of people have lied for other people for a lot less when your life wasn't even nowhere near danger. So let's put all the facts on the table, and let's not jump to conclusions, but let's also really, really, really think about what we're talking about and not just be the one who's just, well, shit. She fucked up in these things. You got to understand how trauma works. And if you have no idea how trauma works, we're breaking it down for you.
And even if there was no trauma, you still can't get away from the drug component of it. I mean, if she's paranoid from a 2-week cocaine binge, well, that's trauma in and of itself. Like, you're
right.
not thinking correctly, even if you have the capacity to. After you've been binging cocaine for 2 weeks.
But you also got to ask yourself, how the hell did a 16-year-old get on cocaine?
Right, right. And that goes into the community issue of it. Who are the people around? And I know everybody's going to say that, well, she was in a negative environment. But this is, for me, where the conversation gets expanded. Why are the kids in the hood in negative environments while those of us that know better are sitting outside of the hood just talking about it, scared to go in there and actually talk to the kids?
I tell you why, because they full of shit. That's why.
Like, when does it become a big enough issue for us to go into these troubled communities and actually begin to affect the next generation to show them alternative choices and alternative ways of
right.
being?
Without cameras and without seeking
right.
validation and somebody patting you on your back because you went in there and did that. You did. You should be doing it from the goodness of your heart. But that's a great question, though, because Centoria Brown is the one that we know about.
Right.
Just imagine how many different young black girls and black boys who are in situations like this that we don't know about. At least we know about Centoria. But it's like, it's too many questions around this for us to just be like, well, lock her up and throw away the key. I'm guessing the juries that she's dealing with got to be either predominantly or all white.
I'm not sure, but I do know that there's the community component we just talked about, where I think we have to get out. Because even if you're just going into the hood, just doing something as simple as going into the hood and picking up trash, you know, just something. But there's that component. The other component is that, like we started talking about earlier, how they're making this dude the victim, and nobody's really talking about the fact that he was a predator.
Right. He was a sexual predator picking up 16-year-olds.
Right. He was a predator. And then the third component for me, she admitted that he didn't deserve to die. She admitted she was wrong. She admitted she couldn't fix it. She admitted all of that. The fact remains, she did all this when she was 16. She's 30 now.
Right.
She was 16 years old. I don't care how mature and how whatever a 16-year-old is. They're still 16. Especially when they coked up on drugs, they're a dangerous 16. And when they got a loaded handgun as well, they're a super dangerous 16. I find it hard to think of anything that a 16-year-old could do to warrant them being locked up until they're freaking 64.
I mean, well, for one being, well, let's just be real. She got that like that because she black. Let's just be real. Like, she got that like that because she black. And dude may not have deserved to die, but dude did fuck up. He deserved Chris Hansen to be popping up on his ass. But it's like, even like what we was talking about before we started recording, like, from what I've read, I believe she shot him because he made some sudden movements that threw her off. Because she's already fucked up. Like, she's already fucked up, traumatized, all these things. Him reaching under the bed threw her off. So she shot him because she was fearing for her life, because she thought he was going to grab a gun and shoot her, according to what she's saying. But if you think about, because I don't know about a lot of people, I've done a lot of work with people who have been abused and been on drugs. And like, I do a lot of work with teens and adults, and I hear stories and I see things and I see patterns and all these things here. And when you are fucked up on life and you coked up and you were deep into this world, like, there's certain things that people do that can throw you off. And in that situation, that was fucked up. But let's take the fact that she intended on robbing him. Let's just put that scenario on the table. Say she intended of robbing him. They got there, everything went according to plan, and she was able to get him. Dude still picked up a 16-year-old.
Right. You can't get around that. You can't get around the fact that he picked up a 16-year-old.
Right.
And even if we'll say the worst case scenario is true, even if she did go to his house to rob him, he fell asleep. She shot him in the back of the head while he was asleep, took $172, took his car, and went back to the motel room with Cutthroat. Even if all of that is true and it was intentional, I still find it hard to sentence a 16-year-old coked up, traumatized child to 50+
That's some hard shit.
Years in prison.
Especially when you have white males who are out here raping people and killing people who are getting 90 days in probation. When they got caught in the act of doing shit, and you got white men who are literally getting away with murder because they were born into rich families.
Oh, let's throw this out there too, because she took two of his rifles as well. So we got to add that in. So she stole $172, two of his rifles and his truck.
But even
it
doesn't. But even now I'm thinking about things though. If he was asleep, did she have to shoot him if he was asleep?
Well, that's the angle the cops present. If he was, you know, like she was, that's their angle. She was a cold-blooded murderer.
Come on, man. Come on. She a cold, now she's a cold-blooded. So the white dude who gets drunk in his car, goes and kills people, he's a child who made a mistake, but she's a cold-blooded murderer. Stop that shit, man.
And see, like, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, because it's just like all that don't add up to me. It sounds like Buddy wasn't asleep. Because if he was asleep, she don't have to kill him. She could just take his stuff and leave. Come on, man. Like,
Wait, Joe. You can't, because to me, the key component in all of this is that she was on a 2-week. She was in the process of a 2-week cocaine binge.
If
she was paranoid, coked up, and paranoid and traumatized, then he could have made a sudden move in his sleep that triggered her. So that's why I say that to me, even when you take all of that, if you want to say it's true, which I'm not saying I do, but I am saying that I could see how her being on drugs, especially cocaine, for 2 weeks, you're 16.
Right.
It's grown people out there that can't handle cocaine. You're
right.
Giving it
now,
16-year-old, so.
Now, I'm with you. I'm listening to that. I hear that. But you ever been around somebody who's been coked up?
Not on a 2-week binge. I've been on somebody that's snorted a line or two.
Because, well, I can't definitively say that I've been around somebody on a 2-week binge. But I'd be around people who be coked up all the time. And it could be 2 weeks, then it could be longer. I'd be around people who coked up all the time. And a lot of times, you know, violence can happen. Violence can ensue and all these things. But a lot of times, those people just, you can coax a cokehead or whatever to do some crazy shit. But a lot of times, violence is not the first thing that they go towards.
Yeah, but those are also not people that have been traumatized violently.
Well, I'm just thinking about some that I've encountered personally. Some are, most aren't. But it's
when you add in the entire situation, because I hear what you're saying, and I do understand as well for those of you that have made the statement that coke affects different people differently. I get all that, and Joe gets all that. So, but I think for me, it's just you look at the scenario. One, this 40-year-old white man. She's 16. She's coked up. You got a 40-year-old white man. He convinced you to get in his car and go to his house. When you get to his house, he shows you his guns. Now, we don't know the nature of how he showed her his guns. Was he playing? Was he being jovial? Was he being threatening? Was he being braggadocious? So that whole error, that whole component of him showing her his guns, that could have set the tone for everything. You know what I'm saying? At that
right.
point, she could have been like, yo.
This nigga trying to get me.
Right.
And then according to her account, him reaching under the bed, because she didn't shoot him with his gun. She shot him with her gun.
Right.
She stole his gun.
Right.
Right. And she stole the guns that were shown to her, but she shot him with the .40 cal that she already had on her.
So, like, the conversation for me... And I've already said what the conversation for me is. She even if the worst case scenario is true, I still have a hard time believing. But for me, the frustrating part about the narrative surrounding this conversation is that it's focused on her. And I'm not saying
right, just her.
We shouldn't fight to get her free, but I'm saying that nobody is trying to prevent, except for her, during her juvenile justice work that she's been doing since she's been locked up. But outside of her, nobody is using her story to try to impact other communities and try to prevent this thing from reoccurring. Nobody's talking about going into the hood. Nobody's talking about getting into the foster care system, which is a whole nother discussion, because you got a whole lot of people out there who are trying to force women to have babies who don't want to have babies. Meanwhile, they're not doing anything to work with the babies that are in the foster care system to make sure that those babies are taken care of. Like, there are so many different branching points for her story that you could take this into other conversations, and none of those branches are being looked at.
Yeah, I mean, it's so many fucked up layers in this story, because it's like, it still goes back to the fact that Buddy still picked up a 16-year-old. You still can't get around that. And the dude cutthroat, the fuckboy cutthroat, he's still like, it's still other components in this, the adult components that don't add up, the adult components that fail.
Right. Literally all of the adults. I say in the city she grew up, all of the adults in Nashville, all of the black people in Nashville,
they failed. They
all failed her. All of
them. They failed.
Every lie, even if you didn't know her, you still failed her. That's how you got to look at it.
Because, I don't care if people don't agree with like what I'm saying about this case, and just because for me, it's another case of a black woman who's being re-victimized by the fucking system. I don't care if she knew the pimp for 2 weeks.
Yeah, the length of time that she's known him really doesn't.
And because it's just like the stuff that people are saying, it's heartless, cold-hearted stuff, and it sounds like people who've never dealt with anybody in these realms or anything, and just people who just, and we know how the jury system works. You just sit down, you pick 12 motherfuckers out of nowhere who seem the most sane but may not know shit about shit. So it's just like this case is crazy. I hope she gets clemency. So you got people like Rihanna and Kim Kardashian who are using their platforms to bring awareness, because Rihanna tweeting about it not too long ago actually brought more light to the case, and people are talking about it. Then you said a documentary was made, correct?
Well, the documentary came out in 2011. So
okay.
Her story has been known for a while, and that's where we do have to give a shout out to Rihanna and the other celebrities, because they gave, you know, they basically gave the story.
They reignited the story.
Because, you know, for the documentary to come out in 2011, and, you know, documentaries are popular, but we know, you know, most people ain't watching documentaries. So,
right.
But yeah, I mean, it's a sad case. I hope she gets it as well. I hope, because, you know, she's been in prison for 14 years, since she was 16 years old. So we can be positive that, one, she's matured, and that,
right,
two, she's not addicted to drugs no more.
Right.
So I think, right, if you add both those things together, you get a completely different human being, especially now that she's not dealing with the trauma of potentially being pimped, of being in a neglectful or abusive relationship. But, I mean, we still got to go back to, and this is the way I feel, anytime anything happens in a city that I live in with a black kid, I feel responsible for it. Especially if it's negative. Now, if it's good, I don't, you know, whatever. But if it's negative, because I feel like there's something that I could have done, you know, if I had a went to this community more often, if I had a just maybe occasionally knocked on the door, maybe when I'm walking through the streets, I see a little kid, maybe if I would have spoke to this little kid, maybe that would have been enough. And I think that's the view we all got to have, man. People got to stop being scared and go into those communities. And even if you don't talk to the adults, talk to the fucking kids.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, man, because this is a sad story. So we're not going to be the dead horse on this today, but we will come back and talk about the story more.
Maybe you can answer my question on this, because I didn't research this. Why is there such a push to get the governor to grant her clemency before he leave. Are they planning on stopping once the new incumbent comes in? Like,
I'm guessing
the lame duck angle, but that doesn't.
I'm guessing they believe that's the best chance she has, unless the incoming governor just full of shit. I don't know.
Well, the incoming governor is they're both Republicans, so that's kind of where I'm like, okay, I get lame duck, whatever, but that just because he's not going to be governor doesn't mean he doesn't have any more political aspirations. So.
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure why it's such a push for this governor. I'm guessing, like I said, I'm guessing because they feel like he will be more apt to giving her clemency than the incoming governor. So. Hey, yeah, but anyway, but Satoya Brown, so do your research on it. There are court documents, read the court documents, like become involved. But Satoya, like Pat said, Satoya Brown is also should be a reminder for you to get involved in your local community, in your own damn city. If you are a person who isn't doing anything in your city and you just want to do something to help people, well, give you a quick thing that you can do. Whatever you're good at, whatever skill, talent, whatever you have, go teach people to do that. If you're a painter, go to your hood, find kids who might be interested in painting, and start painting. Hell, set your paint board up, your brush, your easel, and start painting and see how many kids come ask questions and start teaching people how to paint. Just start with whatever you know, because that's a great way to make an impact on somebody else's life. All right, so the second half of the things that we want to talk about today is I don't want to use the term Mahatma because that's more of a term of endearance and reverence, but Gandhi. Gandhi is back in the news now because a man in Ghana has released a new book, and the new book is basically shedding light on Gandhi's racist views towards South Africans specifically, but all African people, especially at a time where Gandhi was fighting for the rights of Indian people, but at the same time fighting to keep black people oppressed. And there are many documents, there even Gandhi's own writings that indict him and his behavior. Now, the reason why this is coming up is because, like I said, at the University of Ghana, they've removed his statue. But you also have people like Nelson Mandela, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who looked up and revered Gandhi and even took some of his tactics as far as nonviolence and incorporated that into the things that they were doing. But, you know, just overall, worldwide, for those who don't know about the things that Gandhi said and the work that he did to further oppress African people, Gandhi is looked at as a hero. He's an icon. But for those of us who do know, like I told somebody about eight, nine years ago, that's the first time I learned, even before that first or second Hidden Colors come out, where you had Renoko Rashidi say he doesn't want to call Gandhi Mahatma Gandhi because Gandhi's racist views. But when I found out that Gandhi had these ideas towards black people, I had a homeboy who at the time he was like, man, Gandhi is that dude. And I was like, man, Gandhi ain't shit. Then I went on to tell him things about Gandhi. Of course, they didn't believe me. But now there's more and more information coming out about that. So, Pat, what are your first thoughts on this when you hear about Gandhi being exposed?
I mean, like I told you when we talked about it, I honestly thought everybody already knew.
I did too.
And I thought that everybody already knew. I thought that people had known for years because, you know, everybody I know knows that Gandhi didn't like black people, you know, that he was racist against black people. So
he called us kafirs, and a kafir is basically like a nigga on steroids, basically.
So, yeah, it's a derogatory term for black people, or people with black skin. So, and it's you know, we have to differentiate that for African black people, because there are dark-skinned Indians, dark-skinned Indians as well.
Right, but when you're talking about actual African people from the continent.
So, like I said, I thought that everybody knew. And when you look at a lot of the work Gandhi did, Gandhi was fiercely for Indian people. He was for his people. That's one of the traits you can admire, that he was all about getting his people freedom and getting his people the ability to self-identify, to, you know, take care of themselves. And like I said, that's an admirable trait. But when you look at what he did in terms of the black people, you know,
right.
He actively sought to separate Indians from black people wherever he could. And he fought for Indian
right.
liberation while simultaneously doing several different things to keep black people,
people
in
correct.
Bondage in South Africa.
Right. Because he didn't believe, well, he believed that Indian people, if they could be on the same level as white people, but Indian people were still better than black people. And black people, he rarely referred to blacks as naked animal dwelling people. So he thought like the life of an African person was just to, and they got quotes. Let me try to find them. He was talking about We was talking about raising cattle and just living a life of nakedness. So he says, Gandhi's Indian empowerment argument, critics said in a petition to remove the statue, appeared to be that the British colonial government treated Indians a little better, if at all, than the savages or the natives of Africa. He spoke of the half-heathen native and said, treating Indians like Africans would degrade us. The sole occupation of raw natives is hunting. He said, and their sole ambition, this is what I was saying, getting through. Their sole ambition is to collect a certain number of cattle to buy a wife and then pass his life in indolence and nakedness. Fuck you, Gandhi.
Yeah, and
say,
so this becomes interesting because a lot of the people that do look up to and that do revere Gandhi are pushing back hard. And these are black people. And what's interesting about that is that we're faced with clear evidence that Gandhi did not like black people. But because black people have been so trained to love Gandhi, we can't accept what should be at this point common knowledge, because the facts are just out there at this point. And that speaks to indoctrination. That speaks to how we are mentally, how we're set up in the power of the education system. That speaks to our lack of ability to deal with cognitive dissonance properly. That speaks to just a slew of issues. You know, Joe, I was telling you even earlier about a conversation I was having with somebody earlier this weekend who sought to redefine what it meant to be racist.
Right.
Because they couldn't deal with the fact that Gandhi was racist.
But my question for everybody, what has Gandhi done specifically for black people for us to revere him so much? As far as, I didn't ask what he did overall. I'm asking what has he done for black people to earn such reverence from us towards him for us to defend him, if all the information is telling you that Gandhi was against you and your people.
But that goes back to the indoctrination, though. I mean, one could say that he inspired Martin Luther King. He inspired Nelson Mandela. He also inspired a lot of the nonviolent movements of the civil rights era all across the world. You know, Gandhi inspired that. So go ahead.
But those nonviolent movements helped black America and black people how? Because especially like let's not even start here in America. Let's talk about South Africa, and they're still reeling from the decisions that Nelson Mandela made to this day. They're getting ready to go to battle against white people, real bloodshed against white people for their land, because Nelson Mandela made deals that were in favor of white people and not in full favor of the black people. That's why they're still suffering from that to this day. And the nonviolent movement in America helped black people how?
Well, I think you can say the nonviolent movement helped black people, but it helped black people because of the violent alternative that was there. You know, Martin Luther King would not have been as effective as he was without a Malcolm X. You know,
right.
the civil rights protests in several cities in the South would not have been as effective as they were without organizations like the Deacons for Defense, who,
right,
you know, their children and their wives and everybody was out marching nonviolently, but they were standing behind them or beside them with a shotgun saying, okay, if you touch them, we will get very violent. So, you know,
well, right. And I get that angle, but also when, like, let's say if we're talking about just the nonviolent movements, because remember, like, a lot of nonviolent movements didn't really get national attention, didn't really get changed until the white people who joined those movements started getting right. their ass whooped.
Right. And even to that, the nonviolent movement in terms of leadership was very much co-opted by the white liberals of the day, you know, that wanted to come in and wanted to tell black people how they should fight for their freedom.
Just like the abolitionists with Frederick Douglass, man.
And that's one of the primary reasons why the nonviolent, the violent movement, if you will, or I prefer the alternative movement, isn't recognized and praised the way it is, because a lot of those white liberals that were coming in, they detested the violent movement. They did not like the alternative movement, not one little bit. But those are the people that grew up and told the stories and wrote the narratives about the civil rights movement. That's why people, groups like the Deacons for Defense and groups like the Black Liberation Army, that's why all of those people aren't well known, because they didn't like those people. So I do, you know, I give Gandhi credit for inspiring the nonviolent movement, but I can give Gandhi credit for inspiring something while at the same time saying fuck you for being a racist. Like,
right.
I mean, but
because essentially Gandhi was cool with stepping on black people to liberate Indians, and for that he a bitch.
Yeah, and it wasn't even like he had to.
Right.
Gandhi, honestly, from everything that I've read and seen, he honestly felt like Indians were superior to black people.
Right.
So, is there a lot of people trying to play the whole, well, he was just being a strategist, and he was just trying to use white supremacy, blah, 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 blah.
All right. Okay. That's why go read the compensatory code from Neely Fuller Jr. People have to read that. The compensatory code is explicit about what white supremacy is and what white supremacy isn't. If you are using white supremacist tactics to further your cause, then you don't get it. The whole purpose of what we do to fight white supremacy is to eliminate all ideas, tactics, movements, all those things. It's not adopting those things. It's getting rid of them. So people have to do their damn reading. And that'd be my problem. Like, people think that they understand racism, but they really don't. You're not going to end racism by indulging in racist tactics.
I mean, you said it all.
I mean, but because the conversation that you were having, that we were talking about, that you were having, and the young lady was saying that she's okay with using those tactics to get to what she wants, she needs to study the compensatory code. You need to study what racism really is and how you counter racism, because you can't counter racism with racism. Like, that's not what we're not here to dominate people. We're here to free ourselves from it. You can't talk about my eye on one end and then be like, well, we're going to kill these crackers. Nah, that's not my eye. Now, my eye don't mean you be a dumbass and just let the crackers walk up on you. It means you do what you have to do when you have to do it. But the main thing is, we're trying to get away from this shit. And Gandhi clearly was cool with indulging in racism.
Yeah, and that has to be the beef, because there, like you said, well, here, we'll say this, and building up, and you said it before, when we aim to build up our people, if we stoop to the tactics that we use to oppress our people, we become our oppressors.
Right.
For as many of us that hate the oppressive nature of white people, it seems pretty disturbing that we are so willing to accept that nature and become that, because we believe that that's the only way to defeat them. Which is interesting, because it also presents this strategic argument that, you know, and I say this a lot, that I'm going to try to out-muscle the Hulk. Like, the Hulk is strong and he been boards, and the only thing he understands is strength. So in order to defeat him, I got to be stronger than him. And it's kind of silly when you think about it, because you can't out-brute a brute. That's what they do.
Right. Right.
So why don't we think about other ways to, I mean, we need to recognize their tactics, and you've said as much before, we need to recognize their tactics and their strategies, and we need to develop plans to counter them. But we don't need to become them to do that. So it's just, for me, it's always been interesting, especially, you know, it seems like the more people say they hate white people, the more willing they are to become a white person.
Right.
Interesting.
But once again, that for me, it goes back to you not understanding what you're truly doing and what's going on. If you don't understand racism and white supremacy, what it is and how it really works, everything else you seek to understand will only confuse you. Neely Fuller Jr., study the man. There's certain people you need to be studying. You need to study Amos Wilson. You need to study Neely Fuller Jr. You need to study Francis Crest Wilson. You need to study Dr. John Henry Clark. You need to study Yusef Ben Yakin. You need to study Walter Williams. Like, Chancellor Williams, study him as well. You need to study the OGs in this, even before you get to Umar Johnson. Even before, because I have the Dr. Joy DeGruy book, her post-traumatic slave syndrome. I have the new Jim Crow. But I decided that I'm going to read the compensatory code and reread the ISIS papers before I read them, so I can have a proper foundation of what racism truly is before I start reading about what racism did. Because if you don't have that, you're going to have clouded views. You still have a European, your foundation of everything you think about racism is still Europeanized. And so that's how you get these people who want to give Europeans a second chance and all these things. We're not trying to be them, but we ain't trying to give them no chance to advance as well. And we're not trying to indulge in the things that they're doing. Gandhi did exactly. Gandhi did not understand racism. He didn't understand racism at its core, what it was. What he did understand is how it affected his people. We all can see how it affects our people. But Gandhi, being a person who obviously got some malice, some maliciousness in him, decided, hey, well, these tactics work against us. Let's also help further these tactics against African people, or who he could, or how he referred to African people as Kafirs.
I would push back on saying that Gandhi didn't understand racism. I think Gandhi did understand racism. I think Gandhi was not intending on helping black people either in South Africa or in the South of America. I think that wasn't his goal. His goal was to liberate Indian people.
He was a liar. He was a worldwide liar, because there's also information and reports that Gandhi, because the story was changed about him. So either he didn't understand racism or he was a bold-faced liar.
Well, I think there are two components to that. One, I do think a lot of his words were taken out of context. And that's not a good or a bad thing. That just is, because he could have meant something darker than what we're attributing to him, or he could have meant something better than what's attributed to him. But I do think, because when you look at, and here, I'm going to read a section from the book right now that talks about how a lot of black people didn't even really, they never really understood what Gandhi's message was, or they didn't really understand what Gandhi was.
Right.
So it says, some black intellectuals were more skeptical when talking about his nonviolent stance. The socialist E. Franklin Frazier thought nonviolence would not work in the barbarous conditions of the American South. Suppose there should arise a Gandhi to lead Negroes without hate in their hearts, he wrote. I fear we will witness an unprecedented massacre of defenseless black men and women in the name of law and order. And then it goes on to say, in fact, Frazier's own intervention showed how actively Gandhi was being discussed in the black press. It was because black newspapers from Chicago to New York and down into the Deep South were writing so appreciatively about Gandhi's relevance to America, the sociologists sought to temper their enthusiasm. These African-American commentators had not met or seen Gandhi, nor as yet had, and then it goes on and goes on and goes on. So that, to me, that's the key. These African-American commentators talking about the black press had not met or seen Gandhi. So you had the black study people, if you will, the sociologists saying, hold on. Gandhi ain't like, not only is Gandhi whatever, but the tactics are not the tactics we want.
Right.
The black media was saying that Gandhi is that dude and this, that, and third. So I think that adds another wrinkle into why we praise him. And I think that goes into us looking at the successes that Gandhi was having and us thinking that, well, if Gandhi's, I think that's more a reflection of how we didn't understand racism.
Well, yeah, I agree that, but I say that Gandhi, and I was thinking that Gandhi didn't understand racism, because if the goal was to fight racism, but you use these racist tactics, either you didn't understand it, or you understood it, so you understood it to a point to where you could use it against people, but you would also lie about it on the back end or in your story, because he had a hand in rewriting his story.
I think Gandhi was congruent. And by that, and that's one of the only praises I give to Gandhi. I think what Gandhi thought and felt and did were all the same. So, but I also think Gandhi was a master. He was a master speaker. He was really good at conveying messages in ways that would generate the desired emotion or the desired outcome. And I think in a lot of cases,
Pastor Simmons do that.
Yeah, there are a lot of people like that. And I think in a lot of cases, people read what Gandhi wrote and they interpret it as Gandhi is talking to me or about my situation. And I think that's where the misunderstanding comes in. When you read Gandhi's quotes, Gandhi is talking about Indian people. When he's talking about love and overcoming,
he's only
hate,
talking about his
blah,
people.
Blah, blah. He's talking about his people. That's the way I read it. So when I read it, I don't read any lies or any disconnect, because I view it as this is Gandhi's view for his people. Now, if I read it as this is Gandhi's view for humanity, then I'd be like, okay, well, he's lying his ass off because he hated black people.
Yeah. Well, see, but he's looked at as humane person. He's looked as that. Now, you know, I don't have a problem with nobody fighting for their people, but I got a big problem with you when you step on my people to fight for your people.
Right.
You know,
right.
And he has to be called out for that, because he was a bitch for that.
And that, for those of you wondering, that bit I just read was from chapter 8 of the book we're talking about that sparked this new conversation, Gandhi, the Years That Changed the World. So that's from chapter 8. The Mahatma from Above and Below. So if you get the book, you know, that was a little excerpt from it.
Yeah, but once again, though, if you call yourself an opponent of racism, and this moving forward for black folk, if you call yourself an opponent of racism, then you cannot logically engage in racist acts, thoughts, or anything like that. And racism invades every area of human activity. So we have to be able to understand that. And, you know, Gandhi was, like you could say, he was congruent. He was a fuckboy, basically, because, you know what I'm saying? Like, in public, in his prime, in public, he was out raising his people up, stepping on black people. But as he moved forward, and as he got older, and as he moved forward and becoming more of a figure, his story started to change. Like, a lot of stuff became buried, and he had a hand. He didn't have a full hand in it, but he had a hand in that, and we have to be able to understand that. But this is just a lesson that vet these people before you make them your hero.
Well, that can't be overstated. That's something we need to do a lot more often. That's something that needs to be said a lot. We need to spend a significantly larger amount of time doing research on people that we're following. And that, you know, we had a show on leadership.
Yeah.
Look, we are so quick to hop on the bandwagon and just celebrate people. And you see it even here with this Gandhi story. If you want to believe the story, you know, what I just read from the excerpt that I just read from the book, you know, we hear a story about somebody doing something for their people. And one of our greatest attributes is our empathy. We instantly connect to other people. We see it right now with the Hispanic people and immigration issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how quick we are to emotionally attach ourselves to somebody else's struggle. And in a lot of ways, that's an admirable quality. But it becomes a liability and a hindrance when you're attaching yourself to the struggles of people who aren't attaching themselves to your struggle. And so we got to learn how to temper that urge to want to connect with other people. And we got to learn to do our research. I mean,
right.
And that's just what it is for me.
But I still do have a problem with us attaching ourselves to other people's struggles while overlooking our own struggle.
Oh, well, yeah, most definitely.
You know, because there's a lot to be cleaned up within our community. There's a lot that we could do for ourselves that we choose not to do. And it hurts us. So we have to really, really, really be able to look at that and like, come on, man, it's nothing. As human beings, if racism didn't exist, human beings would just be getting along, doing all types of other stuff. Like a lot of the issues that are issues wouldn't be issues if racism didn't exist. But because racism didn't exist, and the concept of race in itself is racism. Racism is, and because remember, the idea and the concepts and everything of race and racism came out of slavery. So racism, the concept of race, which is racism in itself, and racism is the practices of that, came out of slavery, because it was created to justify why African people were enslaved. It was created to say that African people are inferior, they're on the same level of animals, so it's okay for us to enslave them because they're not human. And so they classify people by race. But remember, race ain't what race is. At the end of a race, it's still a competition for resources and all these different things. And so in this spirit of competition, Europeans have an upper hand. They create this thing called race and racism. So you have to be able to understand that and how it works and how it operates. Go read the books.
What?
Read Neely Fuller Jr.'s Compensatory Code. Read Dr. Francis Crest Wilson's ISIS Papers. Read the works of Dr. Amos Wilson. Like, read these works.
Well, I just want to make one final statement.
Go ahead.
And that's in regards to the statue. Because that's, you know, of late, black people have been getting real excited about these statues being pulled down. And
that's more of it.
To me, not only is it a pointless moral victory, but it actually does more harm than good, in my opinion. And that's because we're not trying to face history. We're trying to change it. We're trying to erase it so that we don't have to deal with it. And that's what all of these people that want to pull these statues down are, in my opinion, that's what they're getting at. Why should I have to look at this statue every day? Because it's a reminder of what this country was to you. why are you so anxious to tear down that reminder, even though the country is still the same way to you? So leave the statues alone and teach your kids the truth about them. You know, why aren't we, instead of tearing the statues down, why aren't we just opening up the discourse around the statues so that the entire truth of the situation can be taught? That's what I think should happen. If they wanted, if America erected these statues of these racist figures, leave them there, because that highlights a period of time where America celebrated racism. And right. When we get to a point where America no longer celebrates racism, those statues can still be there as a reminder, and we can erect other statues for people that stood up against it. And that's how you develop a holistic picture. But by tearing down a statue, what you're essentially saying is, I don't want to remember. I don't want to recognize. I don't want to deal with. And so in 20 years from now, 30 years from now, when you have little black kids who are saying, and it's already started, when you have black kids saying white people are discriminated against more than black people, and when you have kids saying that racism doesn't exist, and then eventually they're going to be saying slavery never happened, remember, all of that stuff is spurred on by the shrinking of the overtone window, by the narrowing of the available conversation in public discourse. And that's what we're doing right now. We're narrowing the available conversation in public discourse because somebody's feelings are hurt.
Right.
That's all I'm going to say about that. At me, dog.
I mean, you know, if your feelings hurt about what's going on with race, take a real stance to stop racism. I mean, we, like you say, we know, like, ignorance, a lot of ignorance exists. So that's why you have, like, these black kids who are trying to defend this white stuff. And then you got to blame their parents for sticking them in white environments as well, because y'all, hey, parents, black parents, just, like, you got to realize, if you have to drive your child out of your neighborhood to go learn in another neighborhood because you deem those schools better than the schools in your own neighborhood, it's, you're part of the problem. Get off your ass and make the schools in your community better, and stop sending your kids to go learn from white folk. I mean, you're part of the problem. I don't know no other way to tell you. If there are schools in your community that are failing and you are choosing not to help those schools get better, you part of the problem. They need to bust your ass out of that neighborhood too. But we need to really look at racism and how it is and how it works, and really understand it. Study it. Like, you can study racism. Like, you can go back and track to where the concept of race and all those things really started taking in effect within the 15th century. I mean, within the 1500s, 16th century rather. So do that for yourself. But you know, that's pretty much our show. We're wrapping it up. Go do your research on Gandhi. Go do your research on what's going on with Centoya Brown. Because if we don't start studying and start really understanding what's going on, organizing and taking proper action, we're going to be here. Our grandkids are going to be here 100 years from now. They're dealing with the same issues, and it's going to be a lot worse, because, like we told y'all, the earth's going to be a whole lot fucked up then if we don't get that together. Because a part of the throwing away racism and doing away with racism is also healing the earth as well. So gotta look at it from that. So closing remark, Pat.
Power to the people.
Power to the people. Hey, man, y'all put your fist in the air, get your mind right. Just understand, we got a uphill battle to go. We can do it if we do it right. So two fingers in the air like a player, man. Get them things apart. Peace.